Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and with me is my co-host, Josh Molina. Josh, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Phil. I got to tell you, I nearly laughed myself out of my chair when I saw the poster for this show. Good God. Bob Sapp looking like a fat version of Zeus. And I know you get that reference. I'm not talking about the Greek god. I'm talking about tiny SummerSlam. SummerSlam.
No holds barred. Rip. Yes. Gotcha.
Yes. Rip. Yeah, that was his name. Rip something.
I can't remember his last name. It wasn't Rip Van Winkle. I know that. I don't remember. It was like Rip Tyler or Taylor or something like that. Anyways.
Well, yeah, Bob Sapp just looking like this monster. But, I mean, what a disaster. I can't believe Strikeforce booked this guy. No amount of Jimmy Lennon Jr. introducing him could really make up for what we're about to see. You know, we could do the whole show on Bob Sapp. I know you don't want to do that, but no. So ridiculous. And, you know, even if I wanted to throw him a bone and just be like, hey, he's a gimmick and he makes good money, don't hate on him. When you come out to Ric Flair's music with the fancy robe, that's just heresy. I got no love for that.
You better deliver if that's the case.
Yeah.
And by the way, it was Rip Thomas, for those that were checking the correct answer for Hulk Hogan's character in No Holds Barred. It was Rip Thomas. So anyways. wait, real quick, I think it was Suburban Commando where he picked up the guy and he crapped in his pants. He was like, I smell dookie.
I think that was No Holds Barred. It was like
No Holds Barred?
It was the car scene in the garage. Like,
yeah.
Okay. I love bad wrestling movies, which pretty much most of them.
I was gonna say, that'd be most of them except for like The Wrestler. Pretty much other than that, that's pretty much all of them. So, and especially Hogan's career. Anyway.
Yeah, the best part of No Holds Barred was the lead opposite Hulk Hogan, you know, she was a good actress. She was where did they get this actress from, man? How did they find her for this movie? Because she's probably never going to be able to make a movie again after this.
Yeah, I just remember the bad guy being Kurt Fuller, who was like one of the, he was in Wayne's World. He was like, he worked for Rob Lowe's company or what was the TV studio. Mm-hmm. And he was just real smarmy and like real fake, and they were always making fun of him. And yeah, I remember.
Well, he was like the Ted Turner character. I mean,
No, they had the older guy for that. This was like the exec that was like, you know, up and coming. He was kind of the handler for Wayne and Garth. So where are we? Seriously, this is like the farthest off like base I think we've ever gotten.
We had to explain Zeus. Come on. All right.
Yes, I guess. We had to go down that road. All right. So quickly, let's get to the fallout from Four Men Enter, One Man Survives, which was the last Strikeforce event that we covered. So we had a brand new Strikeforce heavyweight champion in Alistair Overeem after he dismantled Paul Buentello. However, as discussed on our last episode, we wouldn't see Overeem back in Strikeforce for almost 3 years, and somehow he held on to the title that entire time. We would also not see George Santiago, who was seen as a potential new contender for Frank Shamrock's middleweight title after he ran through Sean Salmon and Trevor Prangley in a one-night tournament. Why wouldn't he be back? Well, George himself would explain that, and he actually let us know on our most recent episode before this one. We talked with George, and that episode ran last week. It was a great conversation, so if you haven't already, download and listen and check it out. It's a great discussion. And then finally, our light heavyweight champion, Bobby Southworth, was beaten by Anthony Ruiz in a non-title fight, which set up a future title rematch. Also saw wins from Kung Lee and Luke Stewart, taking the next step in their career progression. All right. On November 21st, 2007, 5 days after Four Men Enter, it was announced that Strikeforce would be leaving California for the very first time in its history, heading to Washington State for Strikeforce at the Dome. The event would take place at the 17,000-seat Tacoma Dome in Tacoma, Washington. The main event would feature former Pride Fighting Championships and K-1 fighter Bob the Beast Sapp against Yan the Giant Norte. The 6'4", 350-pound beast was an NFL vet known for his immense size and power, and he would be making his North American fighting debut. Sapp's opponent would again be Yan Norte. He was 6'11", 330 pounds, so this would be a super heavyweight battle, almost 700 pounds of human flesh in the cage. These two are actually former training partners, so it would be on paper an interesting pride-like circus fight, I guess, if you want to call it that. Also featured on the card would be former UFC heavyweight champion and K-1 North America King Maurice Smith, and he would be taking on six-time world kickboxing champion and former WBC boxing champion Rick the Jet Rufus in a heavyweight contest. I did want to mention that Sapp gave an interview around this time saying that he wanted Fedor after he beat Norte. He wanted Fedor. Let that sink in for a second after he beat Jan the Giant Norte. What?
You know, I would have loved to have watched that fight. I think that Fedor probably would have knocked him out just by staring at him, breathing on him, hiccuping, burping, whatever you want to say, because I could just see Fedor landing, you know, that lead right hand and Sapp just tapping out right there. But seriously, like, Phil, how long do you think it would go? Like, let's say they actually book this, give Sapp a little bit of time to dance around, Fedor to chase him. How long does it go?
Pretty much that. Pretty much that. I think Fedor would come in, kind of feel out the distance a little bit. Sapp would take a shot. Fedor would slip it, eat it, whatever, and then hit him back. And, well, pretty much, I think in some ways, a replay of what we would end up seeing in the main event. But we'll get to that. It would not have been a long night, I don't think.
I would never compare Brett the Grim Rogers to Bob Sapp because Rogers was much better. But do you remember when Rogers knocked Fedor down with like that right hand to the nose and just thinking, holy crap, is this guy going to get, do you remember that? I mean,
I do remember that. That was, you know, obviously a very exciting moment. That's one of the things about Fedor though. He can take a shot. I mean, how many times, you know, we saw Randleman dump him on his head. We saw, of course, now they called him Ironhead with a Japanese fighter that I'm totally blanking on his name right now. But he caught him. He's a big heavyweight, looked like a spark plug with arms and legs, caught him and gave him the fish legs, as I think Boss Rutten put it, like, made his legs dance. And I mean, really hurt him. And just a few seconds later, Fedor's got him on the ground. It's Kazuyuki Fujita. Yeah, I had him on the ground and wrapped up in a rear naked choke and choked him out to the point where his tongue was sticking out of his mouth. So yeah, Fedor knows how to take a shot and knows how to come back from it. Obviously, as he's gotten older, he doesn't have quite the chin that he used to. But yeah, unless Sapp just really caught him, I don't think it would have been a very long night for either fighter. So, and that would be a good thing. Thankfully, we never saw that, though. But also on this card, we'd also see George Masvidal take on Ryan Healy, as well as Corey DeVella versus Joe Riggs. And there's some really interesting notes on Riggs. For this whole entire event, really. So I'm going to dump in, or not dump in, I'm going to jump in a little bit and delve into that. But according to an MMA Junkie article around this time, Riggs was actually a replacement fighter for Cedric Marks for this bout. Marks had to pull out with a shoulder injury. While at the same time, Riggs had been announced that he'd be fighting Joey Villasenor at a Strikeforce Elite XC co-promoted event on March 29th, just 5 weeks after At the Dome, which would actually end up being Shamrock versus Lee. Ken Pavia, very well-known manager from that time, he was Joe Riggs' manager, said that Diesel planned to compete at both events. But that was very, very aggressive thinking, because during my research, I learned that Riggs, who was signed to a non-exclusive contract with Strikeforce, which meant he could fight in other organizations, was planning to fight at an event in California in early January, but the CSAC shut down that event before it could take place. Tried to find the reason why, and I couldn't. But Riggs had apparently suffered an injury to his ribs in a car accident the day before the event, so his status was in question. Anyway, so the thought that he would heal in time from that, fight here, not get injured more, and then fight 5 weeks afterward was, again, very aggressive thinking, and it would absolutely not play out that way, and we'll delve into why in just a little bit. I want to jump back to Cedric Marks, which was a name that I mentioned, and that for MMA fans, that may be a name that's familiar to you, and for all the wrong reasons. Over the last year, his name's been in the news a lot. In March 2020, Marks, who was a former Bellator competitor with almost 60 pro fights, was charged with second-degree murder for the 2009 killing of April Pease, who was the mother of one of his children, who Marks was actually in a custody dispute with. And then he's also facing some capital murder charges, with the death penalty as a possible consequence for the January 2019 murders of an ex-girlfriend and a friend of hers. Mark's actually briefly escaped from custody last year in 2019 during a transport. So sounds like a really bad guy. Thankfully, this is probably the only time we'll mention him on this podcast, but just a little interesting note there.
So what you're saying is that talking about the Bob Sapp fight won't be the most depressing thing we discuss on the show today.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, obviously, I don't think there's anything that gets more depressing than murder. So yeah, I don't think Bob Sapp, as much as we dislike him as a fighter, not as a person, but as a fighter, we'll come anywhere close to approaching that. But anyways, I also wanted to mention that in early February, a deal was struck between Strikeforce and Mark Cuban's HDNet. HDNet Fights would be presenting four events from Strikeforce in 2008, starting with At the Dome. Strikeforce joined Maximum Fighting Championships, Sport Fight, founded by Randy Couture and Matt Lindland, M1 Global, which was the home to Fedor at the time, the IFL, Ring of Combat, and other promotions on HDNet Fights. And I also wanted to mention, as part of that, I tweeted out a little bit about this, and we got a tweet from longtime HDNet Access TV CEO Andrew Simon about At the Dome, and he said, quote, "That was a special show in Tacoma. I was new to the business and had just signed with my now friend Scott Coker his first national TV deal for Strikeforce. Bob Sapp headlined, and didn't enjoy Jan Strikes. Also, this guy George Masvidal was in the co-main," end quote. So he said he planned to listen to the show, so if you are listening, hello, Mr. Simon. Thank you for downloading and supporting the show. All right, we want to talk about any UFC or Challengers events that were going around at this time and delve into who the UFC champions were at the time of this event. BJ Penn was now the lightweight champion, as Sean Sherk had been stripped of the title by the UFC after testing positive for steroids after beating Hermes Franca in July of 2007. Penn cut up and submitted Joe Daddy Stevenson in an absolute bloodbath at UFC 80 in January of 2008 in England. GSP beat Matt Hughes for the interim welterweight title at UFC 79 in December of 2007. Matt Serra was supposed to face Hughes after coaching against him on The Ultimate Fighter, but Serra suffered a back injury and had to pull out. So instead, GSP got the interim title shot and won, setting up a rematch with Serra down the line to unify the titles, and that would end up happening. Anderson the Spider Silva was still reigning as the middleweight champion in the UFC. Quentin Rampage Jackson was still the light heavyweight champ. And Minotauro Nogueira defeated Tim Sylvia via third-round guillotine at UFC 81 to win the interim UFC heavyweight title. Randy Couture had turned down a fight with Nogueira, which it looked like it was due to money issues, that he didn't like the offer, and he essentially relinquished the title in the process. So rather than officially strip Couture of the title, they went the interim route, which we've seen commonly in the UFC. Around the time of this event, UFC 82, Pride of a Champion, took place on March 1st, a week after At the Dome. The UFC was clearly on a roll. The event, which took place at the Nationwide Arena in Columbus, Ohio, drew over 16,000 fans for a $2.2 million gate and 325,000 pay-per-view buys. In the main event, the UFC and Pride middleweight titles were unified when Anderson Silva and Dan Henderson clashed, and the Spider submitted Hendo with a second-round rear naked choke. Also in the card, Diego Sanchez, Josh Koscheck, and Andre Arlovsky all came away with stoppage victories, while Yushin Okami knocked out the late Evan Tanner with a knee as well. Sounded like a very entertaining event.
Hey, Phil, I got to ask you, when did the UFC stop naming their pay-per-views? Obviously we know their numbers, but Pride of a Champion, was that a regular thing that they were doing for all 82 where they had like a subtitle of it, or was it just that one? Or
they were definitely... Yeah, they were. I do not know the answer to that. They were definitely still naming events, obviously, at that point. I mean, the other UFC events that we've talked about, that we've mentioned as we've gone through these events, were still being named. I'm quickly trying to research that and see when they stopped doing that. It looks like, oh man, they've got so many events at this point. It's hard to go through all of them. But I'm scrolling through real quick to see. Here we go. UFC. So we just talked about UFC 82.
Yeah.
I see 88 was Breakthrough. And I think that was, 97 was Redemption. 99, The Comeback. Declaration. Relentless was, or Invincible was UFC 112. See if there's, I think that might be, nope, 125 was, so that's weird. So it looks like they slowly phased them out, because they all say, the other ones all say Silva versus Belfort, Penn versus Fitch, that sort of thing. But then you see Resolution snuck in right around there. So I I think 125. I think it was 125, January 1st, so New Year's Day 2011. I think resolution, I think that was the last one, because as I keep scrolling up, I just see so and so versus so and so. So yeah, that's a very good question, but I think that was the last one.
Maybe they got smart. They ran out of names. They got to like
Well, I mean,
Roadblock and Backlash, and they're like, forget it. It's not worth it
yeah,
anymore.
I mean, at some point, you're gonna run out of, you're gonna run out of words.
Yeah.
So yeah, that looks like that was the last one, because I'm all the way in 2013 now, and all I see is so and so versus so and so. So yeah, that except for like, at the troop or the for the troops or fight for the troops or whatever. But yeah,
Do you
yep. So
think
yeah, looks like it was 125.
that that is a pro wrestling legacy thing? Like, do you think that the idea of having a title for a pay-per-view is because pro wrestling had titles for their pay-per-views, or is that just what they wanted to do, sort of in the origins of mixed martial arts having a name like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it probably came from wrestling, because I don't think boxing. I don't know boxing super well, but I don't know modern boxing super well. And I think it's always, to my knowledge, it's always been so and so versus so and so. So
Yeah,
I don't.
there have been a few grudge matches, like Oscar De La Hoya and Julio Cesar Chavez. Like they've had some kind of names, like Revenge or
Okay.
stuff like that, but certainly not as a matter of course in boxing.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, UFC is so firmly entrenched. I don't think they need that anymore. And you're gonna get, I mean, the other side of it is, oh, UFC Roadblock. Okay, well, who's? I'm not gonna buy it because of the name. I'm gonna buy it because of who's on the card. So I'd rather know who the main event is than some, another synonym of carnage or damage or whatever. So,
Sold out.
yeah.
Sorry, you can move on, Phil. I'm
No,
sorry.
I think you need it. I do think you need it in wrestling, though. I do think you need it there. But anyways, all right. So there was a Strikeforce Challengers event right around this time. It was a few weeks before at the Dome. Young Guns 2 took place at the San Jose Civic Auditorium. Not very many recognizable names on the card. Future UFC competitor Darren Uyeno-Oyama, who I'm just going to butcher that last name until I don't have to say it anymore. I'm going to try to get it nailed down. Uyeno-Oyama. I think that's it. He submitted Andrew Valadarez with a first round rear naked choke. And in the main event, Luke Rockhold, one of just a handful of fighters to hold gold in both Strikeforce and the UFC, would make his Hexagon debut, knocking out Josh Neal in under 2 minutes. Rockhold, someone we'll be discussing at length in future episodes.
Just a little bit on Luke Rockhold here. I recently started following him on Instagram, and he's quite the celebrity model. Lots of various glamour shots. But in terms of his Strikeforce legacy, I'm looking forward to when we talk about that, because I mean, I put him right there with Gilbert Melendez and Kung Lee and Josh Thompson as real legends of Strikeforce, and one of the guys who really made a name for himself in the UFC as a champion, and who was able to transition. And Rockhold was just like a great fighter out of American Kickboxing Academy. He's big guy, could kick well, could re you know he was good on the ground. He was very much a star of Strikeforce and one of the pillars and one of the guys who, when UFC eventually took Strikeforce over, you were really excited about seeing Rockhold take on these UFC guys. So I'm looking forward to his impact. He's definitely one of the I think one of the legends of Strikeforce.
I don't think there's any doubt about that, and I'm hoping we're able to get him on the show. I haven't asked him yet. When we get a little closer to, his main run, we'll look to have him on. But yeah, I'm hoping we can have him on. But 100%, one of the guys that should be up there in the conversation with, Kung and Frank and guys like that as the, personification of Strikeforce. Maybe a little, maybe because he had so much success in the UFC as well, he doesn't get, he doesn't get mentioned as much because he really seemed to have maybe equal success in both. Obviously did better in Strikeforce because he never lost there. But yeah, it's I 100% don't disagree with you at all. So hopefully we'll be able to talk to him in the future. But let's get into the event details for At the Dome. Change of pace on commentary for this one, as Kenny Rice, who would go on to be the longtime host of HDNet's Inside MMA, would provide play-by-play-by-play play-by-play with Frank Trigg adding color. Also, the commentators would have access to CompuStrike, which is familiar to most fight fans today. It gave them in-fight statistics to reference live, which they used liberally throughout the event. And I think it actually helped a lot. I really thought it just added a lot to the broadcast. And just overall, Kenny Rice and Frank Trigg were just much better than Brian Weber and Frank Shamrock, in my opinion, on commentary. So I think it was overall the HDNet deal was already paying off. Let's highlight the undercard. Not going to go through every single fight in detail, but just talk about some of the main fights and you know, that sort of thing. But Nathan Coy, who would go on to compete on The Ultimate Fighter as a member of American Top Team and would also fight in Strikeforce a few more times, got a nice knockout of Dave Corshane. Zach Skinner defeated Scott Schaefer via unanimous decision in a featherweight bout. Mike Hayes defeated Matt Kovach via unanimous decision in a heavyweight bout. Far from a technical masterpiece, it was a pretty entertaining fight overall. Two inexperienced guys who would go on to become very experienced. Hayes has fought and beat some big names in his career. He's got wins over UFC vets Jeff Monson and Fabiano Scherner, while he did lose to Andrei Arlovsky and Alexei Oleinik. He would also beat Kovach in a rematch. These two would lock horns again in 2011, and he retired. That would be Hayes retired in 2016 with a 20-12-2 record. Kovach is actually still active. He holds a 17-18 record. He's lost to Cabbage Carrera, but does have a win over a fellow competitor on this card, Maurice Smith. All right, next fight. In a welterweight fight, Lyle Fancy Pants Beerbohm. Lyle Fancy Pants Beerbohm. In case you're not a longtime MMA fan or not a longtime Strikeforce fan, that name may not be familiar to you, but a very familiar name to me, and we'll get to that in just a second. He defeated Relentless Ray Perales via submission, which came via guillotine choke, at 119 of the third round. Lyle Fancy Pants Beerbohm is one of the most colorful, unique names in MMA history. I knew him personally. In fact, I managed him for a little time. The only fighter that I ever managed actually did some negotiation on his part or on his behalf with Strikeforce for a fight that he had, which we'll discuss later on. We got some other stories about Lyle that I'll share as we go along. But
he was I gotta ask you, Phil. We're going to talk about his pants later, I guess, why he got the name Fancy Pants. But as his manager, did you ever have any, or doing PR for him, did you ever have any say in sort of his image or anything or like that? Or did he ever share with you a pair of those pants? You ever try them on? No one was looking?
It's two very different questions. No, I never got my hands on a pair of those shorts. Not that I would have wanted them, to be fair, but... I did talk about his image with him. To me, Lyle, he had a very unique story, very, very unique story. He had been in prison due to drug issues and had overcome that. And his shorts, I thought, made him look really unique. They were very dorky and kind of square and early 90s, very outdated looking. But I think that was part of his appeal, you know, and it, like I said, they made him stand out. And so, that was something that let's keep going with this, you know, and Fancy Pants, like I said, is a very unique nickname. Nobody else has got one or would necessarily want a nickname like that in a sport filled with the destroyer, the crusher, you know, the mangler, the stuff like that. Having a nickname like Fancy Pants just sounds different. So I thought we should go with that. And it was already in place by the time I worked with him, but I definitely didn't try to steer him away for sure.
And I did interview him back in the day, and he was really a nice guy. I did find a pre-fight interview of him on YouTube, and he had this great quote. He said, "I don't want to hurt him, but I do want to make him feel bad." And I felt that was like the perfect
like
gentleman.
Emotionally or physically? I think
he said, you know, he wants to do enough to win, but he doesn't really want to ruin the guy's life or anything, you know. So that's exactly what a guy named Fancy Pants would say. He definitely not a Luke Rockhold, but definitely somebody who has a place in the history of Strikeforce.
Are you saying Lyle's not as handsome as Luke Rockhold, or are you talking about his in-cage accomplishments?
well, let's face it, you know, only Shawn Michaels is more handsome than Luke Rockhold.
Shawn Michaels today?
Age is a killer. I'm talking, you know, mid-1990s. No, what are you doing to me, Phil?
You're trying to get me off track here. You are serving these up, and I'm just spiking them down.
No, what I mean is Luke Rockhold is, as you might say, one of the faces maybe on the Mount Rushmore of Strikeforce, maybe. Beerbohm is not, but he definitely is somebody I associate with the Strikeforce product and the Strikeforce history.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Fair enough. All right. I'll try to lay off you a little bit. Beerbohm was 4-0, had a win over UFC vet Gerald Strebent coming in. Paralis was much more experienced. He was 12-18, having made his debut in 2000. I actually recognized that name when I read it, and I realized as I did my research that he fought for Gladiator Challenge, a client of mine, many times, and I actually helped promote cards that he was on. So that's why his name was so familiar to me. He'd lost to Dennis Hallman and Brock Larson, two big show vets in his career. This entire fight, it was all fancy pants. First two rounds featured takedowns for Beerbohm, followed by strikes. And in the third, he got a submission win via modified guillotine. Very nice showing for Fancy Pants. He'd be back in Strikeforce multiple times. So like I said, we'll be talking more about him. In his post-fight interview, Lyle thanked his sponsors and then his mom for making his fight shorts, which got a big reaction from the crowd. He's a local Washington native, so, you know, I'm sure he had some fans, friends and fans in attendance. But yeah, the Fancy Pants things comes from the, and they're like I said, very much 90s, early 90s neon, Zubaz, you know, like that kind of style, not flowing and big, but just the print was very early 90s stuff that my mom made for me for my pants when I was a little kid. So yeah, but
not the kind of stuff Reebok would endorse.
Maybe back then, maybe they would have back then, but not today. For sure.
Okay.
But yeah, it was it was a good win for Lyle. I thought he had a good showing. Not the most crowd pleasing fight, but it was definitely a big win for him, I think. All right, moving along. Michael Clark defeated Josh Bennett via TKO doctor stoppage at the end of the second round in a heavyweight fight. To me, Clark was clearly the better fighter from the outset. He was in better shape physically, landed some really good shots. By the end of the first round, though, Bennett had a pretty good cut near his eye, which was swelling. I will mention I saw Chael Sonnen and the late Robert Fallis in the corner of Bennett, as well as I think Strikeforce Director of Communications, Micah Fromovitz. Cage side, he was your boss and mine when we worked for Strikeforce.
Yeah.
Then early in the second round, they brought in Ryan Schultz on commentary briefly to promote an upcoming IFL card, which was kind of interesting. Again, that's some of the turnaround for HDNet getting their ROI there. But Bennett, to his credit, he kept pushing forward. He even got a takedown later in the second round, but the ref and the doctor took a look at his eye and stopped the fight. It was pretty badly swollen, and he even had a cut on top of the swelling, which was pretty nasty, and his vision had to be impeded. So they stopped it. So it was entertaining for kind of the bar fight quality fight that this was. But I wasn't a huge fan. But what did you think, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, it's first of all, never judge anybody's ability to fight how they look. That's not fair.
We know how you feel about these guys in your obsession with Paul Buentello and.
Here's the deal. Here's the deal, right? Like, you know, I grew up on Vince McMahon in the 80s, okay? So I know how to book a card, right? You got to book the card based off of the fact. You got to make the fans think what you're watching is absolutely something special and something unique and unusual and not like your dad is fighting, okay? And so I just question whether we want to be highlighting these kind of guys when they don't look like they're badasses, particularly when you just went over the UFC card, you know, and we're talking about that's the competition. And then, you know, Bennett did not look good at all. He was not aesthetically pleasing. And so I don't know. You can't obviously negotiate that sort of thing. But as an observer, as I'm watching this fight card, I'm not feeling like I'm watching the best fighters in the world when I'm watching this. I feel like I'm watching maybe some tough guy. So that's kind of the thing that sort of struck out at me a little bit. It was a decent sort of like slugfest sort of thing, but I was not, you know, basically pleased. Do you think I'm being too critical here?
No. I agree with you. I was kind of, that's essentially what I was saying, is it was kind of a glorified bar fight in a way. way, you know, not really. But so two things there, though. One, and this is very much pro wrestling ism, but the idea is that if you look like the people in the crowd, why are people going to pay to see you? You know, that's, and it's kind of the Roy Nelson thing. You know, Dana, it was never a secret that Dana was not a fan of Roy Nelson, but as long as he was winning, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, I think there's a place for it. I do think that there's a place for it again, if you can win and look, you know, not look aesthetically pleasing, then I don't think you should not be on a card simply because you don't look good, but the bar for your performance is going to be higher. I mean, we just, you know, it's the whole Brockus in WWF thing that he looked like $1 million, but couldn't do anything. And, you know, he got a couple shots because he looked fantastic, even if he wasn't a good worker. Meanwhile, you know, guys like Brad Armstrong, who, you know, well, Brad Armstrong looked great, but guys that maybe didn't look as good physically in
a little bit smaller. Wrestling.
Yeah. But were smaller. But could work, you know, work crazy good matches, won't, you know, they won't maybe never even get a shot. So it just, you know, it's unfortunate, but it is an MMA, not as much as it is in pro wrestling, but it is an MMA. And as much as I'm kind of picking on some of these guys, you know, there's a part of me that I said I was a big fan of the Headhunter. I was a big fan of Buentello, partially because he did look like a guy that walked in off a construction site or something like that, but could still perform and get big wins and get big knockouts. And for a guy like me, who looks more like a guy that walked in off a construction site, or for me, more out of a cubicle or something like that, versus, you know, I look more like that guy than I do like a guy who's, you know, a power lifter or something like that. So to me, that I identify more with a guy that's got a gut, and so to me but at the same time, I don't want to see a card filled with those guys either. So I think it's got its place, but I just think there are fewer slots for that than there are for, you know, guys that do look good. And the other thing is that, yes, MMA fighters, absolutely, you know, if you know any of them, many of them are obsessed with how they look and, you know, count their abs and all that stuff. But that is definitely not the main focus. And most of the guys, they look like that because of the insane amount of training that they do. It's not because they're necessarily, oh, I'm trying to build up my traps, or, you know, I want, you know, these huge quads or whatever. No, it's whatever comes from the incredible amount of training that they have to do, especially if they're full time. And that's, you know, if any of us did that, we'd look, you know, we'd probably look really, really good. So yeah, we're kind of, but I one more thing, I know I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but with Coker, this has always been his booking strategy, is the undercard. There's not a ton of attention paid to the undercard. And if you're wherever the local market is, you want the undercard filled with guys from that local market, because they're going to sell your tickets. Yes, the main card, the main event especially, is going to sell, or it better sell. But the undercard guys are the ones out there that are basically saying, hey, you know, I'm going to sell 50 tickets to my friends and family, or, you know, at the local gyms there, you know, the local gyms will sell. I don't know if they still do this, but they used to sell tickets for their, you know, for the upcoming events for their guys, if they had guys fighting on that event. You need those guys to be able to do that. And so the quality of the fighter is not necessarily, you know, the number one prime thinking when it comes to booking the undercard. It's who's going to sell those local tickets. And Coker has always done that. And, you know, it's a little less so in Bellator, because, you know, they're a national promotion and that sort of thing. But yeah, I think we were definitely still seeing part of that. And these were two local guys. So that was definitely part of it.
Yeah. I think maybe it's this card and the whole collectiveness of Bob Sapp in the main event and his opponent and the heavyweights that we see on this card. I just think it was like another thing to not be the best showing for Strikeforce, for sure.
Yeah. And all that I'm explaining is just the mentality. It's not necessarily a stamp of approval on it, especially after this card. So, but getting back to it, neither Clark nor Bennett would be back in Strikeforce, but there's some very interesting notes on these two. So I want to share a few of those. Clark would fight and lose to some really big names in his career, including Mike Kyle, the late Ryan Jimmo, Travis Brown, and current Bellator fighter Lorenz Larkin. In addition, he would be the very last opponent for Daniel Pewter in 2009. Lastly, Michael Clark would be the one that would end the career of Josh Bennett. That's right. In 2012, these two would rematch, and Clark would knock Bennett out with a spinning back elbow, and Clark would retire in 2016 with a 10-14 record. Bennett, for his part, would lose to current UFC fighter Todd Duffy in 2008, which was his highest profile opponent. Interestingly, Bennett would face both Mike Hayes and Matt Kovach from this card, beating Kovach once, losing to him another time, and then losing to Hayes in both his fights with him. So he fought those two guys a total of four times. As mentioned, Bennett retired after his second loss to Clark in 2012, ending his career at 16-15. All right, George Gamebred Masvidal defeated Ryan Healy via unanimous decision in a lightweight bout. These two combatants, they seem to be pretty evenly matched, with Masvidal holding a 13-2 record, Healy standing at 14-3. Gamebred was riding a 7-fight win streak coming in, which included a TKO win over Matt Lee at Strikeforce's Playboy Mansion show, which is in the archives. Make sure you check that out. As well as a head kick knockout of Eve Edwards at a Bodog fight event. Healy had won three of his last four, losing only to Razor Rob McCullough in the WEC. This was a big fight, no question, and I think it delivered. It was a back-and-forth fight. Both men had their moments, but, man, Healy's nose looked just really gross after this scrap, and that had to have an impact on the judges with Gamebred getting a unanimous decision win. I'll mention that. You know, Healy, as I believe Gorilla Monsoon would have said, had a, oh man, now it was proboscis. It was a prominent proboscis, I think, as Gorilla used to say. So, yeah. Had, you know, kind of a big nose and so kind of a big target, and the bridge of his nose just looked really, really gross. And I think that helped Gamebred get the win.
Gorilla never even met Triple H either. So can you imagine if he had been around?
Yeah, he did. He died in 97. He was part of WWF. So yeah, no, he definitely met Triple H.
Oh, okay. Well, I got to go and find out if he actually called one of Triple H's matches. That'd be great.
I don't think so. I remember Gorilla was the WWF commissioner, because he was in poor health the last couple of years of his life. And you remember that they did the thing where Vader splashed him, and that was from the rope, and that was just a huge, huge deal. And I think I think that was 95. And So Triple H came over to WWF in 95 or 96. I know I think it was 95 when he came over, because he wrestled the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania in 1996 and did that very quick squash job. So yeah. And just to clarify, Monsoon actually died in 99, not 97. So I am nearly positive that they met, although I don't think he ever called any of his matches.
Yeah, he would have called him a triple prominent proboscis for sure.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Right. So I'm not really sure how I felt about the stoppage to look at the cut. So this is before the end, right? And I have this thing about MMA where I get it. I know the origins, and I have full respect for the fact that it's not a real fight. That it's not like a street fight. But, you know, when they stop to look at something and then they put them back in the position, I think it's a real momentum disruptor for a fan. I realize that they have to do that, but we saw some of this, in this fight as well, when they had to stop, look at it, and then put them back on the ground. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you feel like should they just finish the round? I mean, you would never see in boxing where, you know, they would put them back in the exact position that they were. Educate me, help me understand here, Phil, like why is that the best way to do it when you've got a guy who's in bad shape? Why not just let them finish?
Yeah, I agree. They're stopping it to see if they're pausing to see if the fight should be stopped, if the fight is over. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that unless you stop and let the doctor take a look at the cut? You know, they try, you know, no coaching while that's happening. And mm-hmm. I've seen at times where they don't wipe the blood away. They, you know, try to leave them as is as possible. I think it's one of those necessary evils. I can see both sides of it. It's like, yeah, if a guy's cut bad enough, but then the issue becomes a lot of these guys don't want to stop. You know, they're not going to stop for a cut for anything. So they, you know, you've seen how many times you've seen a guy get cut real bad, and you're like, all right, well, that's over. And the fighter's all, you know, all mad because the doctor stopped it. So it's one of those things where, yes, it's at the end of the day, it's a simulated street fight. You know, it's not a real, it's a competition. And I think it should be that way. I wouldn't be a fan of it if it was just a straight up tough man contest. You know, I like the competitive nature of it, but you know, in this case, it was on the bridge of the nose, so it wasn't going to impede his vision. That's kind of the main reason why they stop cuts, or they stop fights to look at cuts, is it causing blood to go into the eyes, which is causing, you know, the vision to be impeded, and so then he can't properly defend himself, so you got to stop the fight.
Yeah.
But in this case, it was on the bridge of the nose, so it wasn't going to get into his eyes enough to where he was blinded or anything like that. So yeah, that part I was like, well, then now they're just checking to see if, like, you can see bone, it's just too deep and you got to stop it. So yeah, this one in particular was questionable because it wasn't going to stop his vision, but overall I think they're necessary, even if I don't like them.
Yeah, okay.
So but in his post-fight interview, Masvidal said he was gunning for the Strikeforce title, and he actually would eventually get a title shot, though it wouldn't be for a while. This would be the start of a slide for Healy, as he would lose four more fights after this one. He would not be back in Strikeforce, but his brother Pat would fight for the promotion multiple times. Ryan would retire in 2014 with a 25-14-1 record. And again, Gamebred would be back in Strikeforce, but despite saying that he would be gunning for the lightweight title, he would not be back until 2011, which is 3 years after this. So we'll be talking more about him in coming episodes, but not for a while.
It was kind of cool to see a young Masvidal. Like, he was just like this young, fresh-faced kind of dude, and so different than how he looks now. And yeah, this is for anyone, you know, listening, this is why we love Strikeforce, is that so many of these guys and girls, you know, male and female athletes, came through Strikeforce, and then they got on this huge stage in the UFC. But if you love the fighters and you love the fighting, like, you get to see them developing here during this stage. And we saw that. I mean, we saw him, you know, Masvidal's a little bit more cautious here. He's becoming who he's going to be as a fighter, and he's learning. And all of a sudden you see him on the bigger stage and you're like, hey, I know what this guy's going to do. I know his tendencies, because you were a Strikeforce fan. And so I think that's one of the things that's so cool about Strikeforce, is just, man, a lot of these guys came through. And I mean, look at Daniel Cormier. Like, you know, what would have happened if there's no Strikeforce? And, you know, does UFC eventually sign Daniel Cormier? I don't know. You know,
yeah.
But is he as good as... I mean, a lot of these guys needed Strikeforce. You know, you put him in the UFC right out of amateur, it's like, they're dead. You know, you know, yeah. look at Aaron Pico in Bellator. You know, he's like this huge wrestling star, and all of a sudden, you know, he gets knocked out a couple times, you know, and so it's like, oh, wait a minute. So you just never know, like, the importance of Strikeforce in the history of MMA is so significant. Sorry.
No, you're 100% on. And we'll be running an episode with an interview with gorgeous George Garcia of MMA Junkie Radio. I think a couple weeks from when this episode drops. And we actually talk about exactly that. Would the UFC be where it is today without Strikeforce as far as the talent infusion? And I said no. And George said essentially yes, but it just may have taken longer. But it's basically like a guy like Cormier, if he doesn't have Strikeforce, maybe he comes in the UFC before he's ready and loses, you know, a couple fights quickly, and then we never hear from him again. So obviously it's all hypothetical, so who knows?
But I mean, you know, one thing that's not hypothetical is Ronda Rousey. I mean, Dana White said he would never do women's MMA, and look at what Ronda did for Strikeforce. And all of a sudden, I mean, Ronda carried Strikeforce for a few years before, you know, Conor McGregor was the next big thing. I mean, I don't know if you could, like, because there's no way Ronda would have had a career in MMA if it were not for Strikeforce. It never would have happened.
Yeah, 100%. It's just one of those things where there are some parts of this that are hypothetical, and there's some where it's just very clear, you know, that there was a massive impact there. So, yeah. But anyways, let's get back to this. We got the main card. We finally arrived there. In the first bout on the main card, Fast Eddie Ellis defeated the Red-Nosed Pitbull. Unanimous decision at 170 pounds. Got to be one of the worst nicknames I've ever heard. I don't know a whole lot about pitbulls, so I don't. Maybe the red nose part is like a specific kind of Pitbull. I don't know, but I just not a fan of that at all. So,
Maybe he had a red nose and he looks like a
yeah,
pit bull.
he's kind of a pasty white guy, so maybe his nose would get real red. I don't know. But two very experienced fighters here, had almost 70 pro fights between the two of them. Ellis was 13, 15, and 1, while Berger was 19, 17, and 2. Berger was a longtime veteran, having made his MMA debut back in 1998. He had a couple fights in the UFC in 2002, having a loss to Benji Raddich overturned because of strikes to the back of the head, which I went back and watched and actually kind of disagreed with. But anyways, and he also lost to Robbie Lawler via punches. He had also lost to Dean Thomas, Jake Shields, and George Masvidal in the years heading up to this fight. So he'd fought a lot of big name fighters. Not a ton to say about the fight itself. I will say the commentary was just so much more professional with Rice and Trigg on the call. And as I said earlier, the CompuStrike data really helped a lot. The deal with HDNet seemed to be paying off right away. Also, Eddie Ellis had Matt Lindland and Dennis Hallman in his corner, which is a pretty good team to have coaching you. No doubt about that. But another fight where both fighters scored some points and had some highlights, but Ellis was the smarter fighter and used a takedown in the third round to really cement the win for himself. He was quite exhausted when the final bell rang, but he got the unanimous decision nod, and I think it was just the way that it went, but it was definitely a good fight for Ellis and yeah, big one for him. Neither fighter would compete for Strikeforce again. Berger would lose six of his last eight fights to close out his 14-year career in 2012 with a 21, 23, and 2 record. Ellis would actually make it onto season 16 of The Ultimate Fighter, so you may recognize his name. He beat David Michaud and lost to Colton Smith, and he left the sport in 2017 with a 21, 17, and 1 record. All right, we are at the co-main event. Maury Smith defeated Rick Rufus via submission, coming from an armbar at 153 of the first round in a heavyweight bout. This was a rematch of a previous 2003 K1 fight, which saw Rufus take a decision victory over Smith. Rufus, the brother of fellow kickboxer and longtime top-tier MMA coach Duke Rufus, who I've also mentioned is a former client of mine, had had a lot of success in both kickboxing and boxing. He had won world titles in three weight classes in kickboxing and held a 13-5 record in pro boxing, and had won a WBC belt during that part of his career.
So why couldn't Duke Rufus help CM Punk?
I wasn't working with Duke during that time, but I will say there's only so much you can do. I mean, that's no disrespect to CM Punk. That sounds disrespectful, but I'm just saying a guy in his 30s with really no real, combat sports experience. Because you'd say, oh, well, Kung Lee was in his 30s when he came to it. Well, yeah, he was also a world champion kickboxer and All-American D2 wrestler, so he had a bunch of experience in combat sports in his background. CM Punk is, just a guy that loved Muay Thai and loved MMA. I don't think he had ever trained it seriously before he got into the sport. So,
I think
what can you do with a guy like that?
Well, CM Punk already won. Actually, he's 36 or 37 when he tried, but I mean, he made weight. I mean, he cut weight like he's a winner to me because he did that whole thing and he didn't have any weight problems. He cut a lot of weight. He got in shape. He did the walk, and God knows what he would have happened if he wasn't with, a good camp. So say what you say. I don't know how many 37-year-old guys you could put in the UFC and expect them to be dominant. I mean, it just extraordinarily unlikely.
Yeah, no, like I said, no disrespect to him at all. I give him all the respect in the world for trying and trying more than once. And yeah, he got a leg up and he had the money to train full time from the very beginning. So, very few people can say that. But, I give him all the credit in the world for really putting his reputation on the line and he did it. So. But anyways, Maury Smith was a former UFC heavyweight champion and a three-time world kickboxing champion. Despite having only a 4-8 record at the time, which we would never see this happen today, he'd beaten Mark Cole via decision in 1997 to win the UFC heavyweight title. After that, he defended the title against Tate Abbott and then lost the belt to Randy Couture. He would return to kickboxing in 2000, fighting 9 times over the next 7 years. And this would be Maurice's second fight in MMA since the year 2000. He had been coaching in the IFL and had actually fought fellow coach and also fellow UFC legend Marco Huas in a super fight in 2007, beating him. And now he was back in MMA again. This would be a pretty quick one. Maurice Smith had his longtime training partner Frank Shamrock in his corner, as well as fellow UFC veteran Ivan Salivary. Another UFC vet, Mike Van Arsdale, was in Rufus's corner. After a little bit of feeling out on the feet, Smith got a takedown of Rufus, getting into half guard. Rufus just, I mean, he just didn't have much to offer on the mat. I mean, there just was very little here, and Smith eventually got a straight arm bar from full mount, which you don't see a lot of straight arm bars, but he listed it, got the tap from Rufus, and Rufus's arm was clearly hurting afterwards, but really pretty quick, not a whole lot to this fight.
Yeah, I was let down by the fight. I, you know, thought it was a little bit boring. Neither one of the guys, to me, looked like they had a lot of enthusiasm and were really excited about the opportunity. Rufus didn't really offer anything, and, you know, Maurice was able to finish him with the armbar. But I was expecting to see a little bit more striking, kickboxing action, but, you know, we got a submission. I don't know. It may have been just Scott Coker wanting to book some of his buddies. We talked about this. We could sort of criticize or offer commentary on the booking of this whole card. But it was another thing that, to me, just, you know, up until now, we're seeing a lot of inconsistency with the Strikeforce shows. Some shows are really good. Others are like, this is not really a Strikeforce show. And this is just another element here that was like, yeah, these guys don't seem like they fit entirely with what Strikeforce is trying to do.
Yeah, this was not a great card, and we've only got one more fight after this one, but this was not a great card. And, you know, I will say, as far as, again, booking a guy like Maurice Smith, former UFC heavyweight champion, a good friend, obviously a very close friend of Frank Shamrock, who's your top star, or top one or two stars. Yeah. You know, he's from Seattle, so he's from Washington, so, you know, hopefully a name that's going to draw some more ticket sales. But when your main event, your two main event guys that you're kind of banking on are, you know, to sell tickets and get eyeballs on TV, are Maurice Smith, who's fought before this, had fought once in the last 7 years and was never a great, great MMA fighter. And then Bob Sapp, a guy who's never fought in North America and is just a big, you know, like I said, circus sideshow type guy. Yeah, this is not great booking in my opinion. And I'm just, yeah, not a huge fan of it. So, yeah, not great. To Rufus's credit, you know, he did stay in MMA for about 15 months and Smith gave Rufus a lot of respect for stepping into the cage with him. And, he said that he'd be back again, but so would Rufus. It's pretty incredible. Rufus actually fought 15 times, I'm sorry, 10 times in 15 months, which is, that is pretty crazy. That's pretty amazing. 9 of those fights came in 2008. So you're just getting into MMA from kickboxing. I mean, this guy, he didn't waste any time. If he was going to find out real quick, if he was, you know, had the chops to be a top level guy, and he didn't, unfortunately. He went 4-6 overall, had losses to fellow kickboxing star Michael the Black Sniper McDonald, Hector Sick Dog Ramirez, and future UFC fighter, the aforementioned late Ryan Jimmo. Smith would fight 3 more times in MMA. He would lose to Japanese Olympic gold medalist and Pride veteran Hidehiko Yoshida at a Sengoku event a few months after this event. Former UFC champ would step back in the cage in 2012, getting a win before retiring for good after a 2013 loss to Matt Kovach. Man, we've brought that guy's name up a lot during this episode. He fought in a heavyweight bout earlier on the card. Maurice's MMA career would end at 13-15, but he would be inducted into the UFC Hall of Fame in 2017. All right. I'm sorry. I said this was the co-main event. We actually have one more fight before we get to this. I still would consider this to be the co-main event just based on the billing and who's on the poster. But there was another fight after this one before we got to the main event. And in this, the one Corey DeVella defeated Joe Diesel Riggs via submission from a slam at 122 of the first round. DeVella was 9-2 coming in with losses to Matt Horwich and Ed Herman. So if you're going to lose to a couple guys, you know, especially at this stage in your MMA career, that those are two pretty good ones. He did have a win over UFC vet, the late Loden Sincade. He was on a 6-fight win streak, but this would be a very big test for the one. As discussed earlier, Riggs was dealing with some physical issues coming in. They would cut this fight short. Riggs had won both his fights since leaving the UFC, including one against Eugene Jackson at Strikeforce's Playboy Mansion show. There was no video. I could not find any video of this fight anywhere, which is frustrating. So we do have this recap courtesy of MMA Weekly. Riggs tied up with the Northwest native early in the round and found his trip takedown attempt reversed by a perfectly executed hip toss. The second Riggs hit the canvas, he grimaced in pain and immediately tapped out. Nearly immobile, an EMT crew took him from the cage on a stretcher. Riggs was able to move his arms and legs, but was clearly in a great deal of pain. And Josh, I know you found a little bit more of a description of what had happened here.
Yeah, Figure Four Weekly wrote about the fight and said, Corey took him over with a beautiful judo hip toss, and suddenly the ref stopped it. Looks like Riggs blew out his back. Place went absolutely haywire. Biggest pop of the night.
Which is another reason why I'm frustrated I couldn't find any video of this. That the one time the crowd really went crazy during this night, and I can't see it because the video doesn't exist. Anyways, go ahead.
Everyone was going nuts, and then they started to realize that Riggs couldn't get up. They loaded Riggs onto a backboard, and it looks like he can move his legs, so he's not paralyzed. Likely blew a disc. People cheered as he was taken out of the cage. A body slam ends this contest, said Jimmy Lennon Jr., which is something you don't hear very often, you know, in MMA from the ring announcer. So that was how Figure Four Weekly summed up the show. And they had a person live at the show covering it.
Yeah, which it wasn't a body slam, Mr. Lennon Jr., but the injury was quite possibly a byproduct of the car crash that Riggs suffered in that lead up to that canceled fight that I mentioned earlier. Agent Ken Pavia told MMAweekly.com that Riggs was at the hospital having the injury checked out afterwards, but nothing else was known about his condition at that time. Devola would actually tell MMA Junkie after the fight that Riggs had told him that he was having some back problems at the weigh-ins the previous day. Kind of interesting that he would let his opponent know that he had some physical issues going on, but he must have been in a lot of pain. Devola would be back in Strikeforce later in the year, so we'll discuss him more on an episode then. And despite his physical issues, Riggs would actually be back on the same show. He would not get to face, he wanted Devola in a rematch, but that would not end up happening. But they would both compete on the Playboy Mansion 2, the second event that took place there. And so we'll talk a little bit more about, about Riggs's condition and the aftermath and all that as we get to the end of this show. But before we get there, we do want to talk about, well, I say we want to talk about, we are compelled to talk about the heavyweight main event. Yan the Giant Norte defeated Bob the Beast Sapp via TKO, coming from punches at 55 seconds of the first round. The best thing that you can say about this fight is that I guess there's two great things that you could say about this fight. Is one, that it ended decisively. There's no question about there was a winner. And number two, it ended in less than a minute. So that was two positives there. But as mentioned earlier, this would be the North American debut for Bob Sapp. He was 9-2 in MMA. I don't understand that. I don't know how he got 9 wins, except to say there's always been a lot of whispers and rumors about fixed fights in Japan. So I'm not saying that's what happened. I don't know. But 9-2, when you see what his record is today, it's kind of insane to think that he had that record at some point.
Maybe he fought some of the same guys Cesar Gracie fought.
And some of the same guys that Josh Thompson fought as well.
So, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, maybe they were doing a good job. All right, anyway, so he, regardless of his record, he was an absolute megastar in Japan. Sapp had appeared on in numerous commercials and TV shows in the Land of the Rising Sun, even released a music album there, which I did not bother even trying to look for. So don't ask if, you know, Josh, don't waste time asking if I listen to it, because I
didn't even try to look for it. Does he have any songs about Hulk Hogan on it?
I have no, I'm not even
going to go there. It's a Macho Man joke. Sorry.
Yeah, go. I'm not even going to go. Yes, I remember the rap album. I remember it. I want to say I maybe even bought a couple tracks off that. So anyways.
Well, you know, if guys like you and I aren't buying that, I don't know who is. Yeah, who is. Yeah.
If loser marks like you and me aren't wasting a few bucks on Macho Man's rap songs, who is? Anyways, Sapp was a star college football player for the University of Washington, so obviously was going to be a huge local favorite. He'd been drafted into the NFL, but he only played one game. All told, I mean, his career was very, very short, but again, did make enough of an impact. He eventually made his way to pro wrestling, was actually under contract. I did not know this, but he was under contract with WCW as a developmental wrestler when the company was bought by the WWF in 2001. I'm kind of surprised that Vince McMahon, maybe he just never learned that Sapp was there, but I'm kind of surprised that we didn't at least see him get a look in WWF. So I'm going to assume that Vince would, probably didn't get to see him. So, or else I would have jumped all over that.
I'm gonna assume Vince took a look at him and said, "What? We've already pushed Zeus 20 years ago. We're not gonna do it again."
Yeah, yeah. I guess you could call him the second coming of Zeus, although. Yeah. They probably had about the same amount of working ability when it came to wrestling. So maybe it would have been Zeus 2.0. But from there, from his release from WCW or just not getting brought to WWF, he did get featured in a tough man competition that was broadcasted on the FX network. I remember those tough man competitions, which I guess were seen by some people from Pride, and they brought Sapp in. He got training for 6 months before making his debut, and he would alternate fighting for Pride and K1, and he did get some big wins along the way, including in kickboxing. He would beat the man, Mr. Perfect, Ernesto Hoost. He actually beat him twice, which is, that's a big deal. So, but regardless of whether he won or lost, Sapp was a big star, and he was going to be brought in to try to draw some eyeballs. Norte had also fought extensively in Japan. He competed in both Pride and K1, but he had lost a lot more than Sapp. In fact, he was only 1-5 in MMA coming into this bout. In kickboxing, he'd lost to Hoost. He'd lost to Jerome LeBanner. He'd lost to Krokop, who had also beaten Sapp via liver kick. I don't know if you've... Josh, have you seen that fight before?
I have not seen that fight.
You should definitely check it out. It's one of those just classic liver kicks where just he caught him and Sapp's face, just you can just see the pain just come across his mush, and he goes right down, and that was all she wrote. You should definitely check that out.
So that's actually a fight that Sapp legitimately lost.
Yes, I did actually feel bad for him on that one. Yes,
maybe he started quitting after that. He's like, I never want to feel bad again.
With this. I get paid whether I win or lose. So why am I going to take a bunch of punishment? So yeah, Norte had also lost to Gary Goodridge. Interestingly, one of Norte's MMA losses had come in 2003 against current WWE star Shinsuke Nakamura via forearm choke. I'm going to have to try to find that one, because Nakamura is what, like 215, 220. Mm-hmm. And so he was outweighed by a good 100 pounds, I'm sure, by Norte. And to get him down and get him in a position to get a forearm choke on him, that's pretty impressive. So I'm going to have to try to look for that one.
Yet Nakamura can't be AJ Styles. I don't know what kind of world we're living in.
Come on. All right.
No, yeah. I'm just saying. Okay, let me just tie that in.
Okay, I see what you're saying. That basically, this is a guy that has legit fighting skills. Yes. And yet, okay, yeah. All right. That's
like I love Nakamura. He's legit. He's crossover. Everything we know. Great entrance, charisma, and a great wrestler, and a great good fighter. And yet, we can't see him do anything but be a heel Japanese guy in the WWE. Pisses me off.
That's fair. Yeah. I gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to the fight itself. The Beast had Matt Hume in his corner, which is nothing to sneeze at, while Norte had Rey Seifo. Lots of boos for the Giant, big cheers for the Beast, no touch of the gloves, lots of intensity in the mid-cage stare down, and it all went downhill from there. Sapp rushed straight at Norte, clinching. Norte created some separation and started just blasting the Beast with left hands, cut him over the left eye in the process. Sapp was hurt and just really wasn't offering any defense. He fell to the mat, and the ref stepped in, and that's your Bob Sapp right there. The two embraced afterwards, showing respect, which actually bugged me more than anything. It's like, oh yeah, we were in this great battle against each other, like two warriors. And it's like, nope. On the mic afterwards, Sapp told the crowd that he was dealing with a quote, massively pulled hamstring, which limited his mobility. I don't know what that had to do with that fight at all. But again, I got asked the question, how exactly did Sapp have 9 wins, not including his kickboxing wins? How did he have 9 MMA wins coming into this fight?
Yeah, let me just say a couple things. Obviously, I've already said how I feel about Sapp, but it's just such a contrast. Like, here's this guy who looks like $1 million, all those muscles, but yet how could he fight like such a frightened turtle inside the cage? It's just mind-boggling. I mean, he was so scared so many of his fights, and he did not really want to fight and use his body or even try to do anything. It's like, if he didn't hit the other guy first, He quit. And so let me just say that that's what bothers me most about Sapp. Obviously, great respect. This guy's won fights. He's won kickboxing fights. He's a tough guy. He's an athlete. He's played football. Okay, great. But my thing is that if you're gonna do this, don't quit. Don't give up at the first sign of adversity. We don't watch MMA. I mean, some people are aspiring MMA fighters, but a lot of people who watch MMA are just like watching because they want to be inspired by the heroes who step in there and give it their all and do their best. And Bob Sapp was just sort of the antithesis of that. And that's what really bugged me, in that he just quit. He gave up, and he was acting as though, I don't know if he is, I'm not going to call him this, but he had a lot of cowardly tendencies after there was adversity. And that's, I think, what bothers me, especially in Strikeforce, when we're talking about all these other great fighters who are putting in so much effort. At one point, I think I saw Sapp grab him and close his eyes. I mean, it was like this guy used to fight with his eyes closed, it looked like he was preparing to get hit or something. And Bob Sapp just looked so uncomfortable inside the cage. And I just did not like his fighting style. I think he just gave up way too early. And maybe I'm judging him harshly because he's so big and intimidating. And therefore, I think, well, yeah, he must be a tough guy too in terms of how he fights. And also, it's kind of like everything bad about MMA when you book a guy based off of how he looks instead of his skills. Figure Four Weekly, Phil, put it this way: there was a moderate pop for the upset, and then immediately everyone was filing out of the building. You never saw people leave as fast as they did right here. They came, they saw Bob, they didn't even seem to care all that much that he lost, and then left. And by left, I mean they were running for the exits. Wow. Jan was so happy afterwards, Bob less so. He was bleeding bad from the eye and was very unhappy about the stoppage. Fight went 55 seconds.
Yeah, that's a pretty good encapsulation of everything that you just said was how I feel about Bob as a fighter. Again, nothing personal, nothing, like an issue with him as a person. I don't know anything about him as a person, but as a fighter, it's exactly what you said there. It just seemed to be so cowardly the way that it was like he's there just to earn a paycheck. No pride, no sense of self-respect. Just I'm just here to, and as soon as any sort of adversity came, he would just give up. And that was, and I saw it happen more than once. And it's just very, very frustrating to see. So yeah, I agree 100%. Thankfully, this would be the only time we would ever see either fighter in the Strikeforce cage. In fact, this would actually be the last one of any kind for Norte, as he would lose two kickboxing bouts and one more MMA bout, which was a knockout loss to Sokaju for Dream in Japan in 2009, which ended his MMA career at 2-6. He was actually still only 34 when his career ended. He looked a lot older than me. I assume he did a lot of, or say, I assume he, I'm guessing he did a lot of partying. I don't know, because he, man, he still didn't look in here. I mean, this is a year before that, so he was 33 at this point, maybe 32, and yeah, he looked a lot older than I do at 38. So, but anyways, Sapp would continue to fight, but would just start suffering a ton of losses. He lost to Ikehisu Minowa, who he must have outweighed by close to 200 pounds. Then he took a loss to Bobby Lashley, and then to Sokaju. At one point, he actually lost 14 MMA fights in a row, which included losses to Hollis Gracie, James Thompson, Marius Pujanowski, Soapalele, and Alexander Emelianenko. Somehow, some way, though, Sapp seems to have ended his career on a high note. He beat Kentaro Osunarashi by decision in Ryzen almost exactly 2 years ago, as we record this, in Osunarashi's only his in his only fight. So obviously he was, I think Osunarashi was a what do they call those, a sumo guy, so not exactly a really experienced guy. But yeah, just I'm glad this is over. I'm glad we don't have to talk anymore about this. I'm glad we can move on, and SAP probably won't even come up again. You in agreement with on that, Josh?
Well, unless he shows up at your door to
Yeah,
complain about
yeah.
how you're talking about him,
Yeah, he
you
doesn't
know.
know where I live in town.
No, I don't think we're going to be talking much more about Bob Sapp unless he makes a return to Bellator or something.
Yeah, but this was very much an ugly event. I'm you know, was not something. I think it was a big step back for Strikeforce. I just don't think there's any question about that. But anyways, you know, they did draw pretty well. I mean, it was 17,000 seat stadium that they or arena that they were in. 7,000 fans paying to be there paid 283,000, set a non-pro wrestling state combat sports record for Washington, according to Figure Four Weekly. So, you know, it was still a financially, I think, somewhat of a successful event. You know, obviously don't know what the TV side of it did, but you know, of course when you see, and we'll get in the salaries right here, SAP got 100,000 of those, you know, $283,000. So, you know, I don't know how much they really end up clearing on that, but he should have given some of that to Norte, who only got 15,000 in comparison, which is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't like the pay scales in MMA at all. I mean, I guess you could argue that, you know, we're picking on SAP here, but really it's the guys at the bottom of the card I think should be making more money. I don't think SAP should be making 100 grand for fighting for 55 seconds, but it's just, you know, these other guys, just they just don't make much money. And I think that's always been one of the challenges of MMA. And it's not just because Strikeforce was an up-and-coming promotion. The same thing still happens in the UFC today. There's a handful of guys who make a lot of money, Conor McGregor and Jon Jones and Daniel Cormier and those type level. But a lot of the guys you see up until that point in the card, they're struggling too.
There's no doubt about that. And you know, we'll go through some of the other payouts. Maurice Smith earned 30,000, Rick Rufus earned 15, Joe Riggs got 15, George Masvidal got 20, and Lyle Beerbohm only got 2,000. So there's a huge discrepancy there, and unfortunately we still see that today. I mean, fighters make more, but there are fighters in the UFC that get 15 or 20,000, and that's one of the higher pays, you know, on a part, you know, like a UFC fight night or something like that. So despite this card taking place 12 years ago as we record this, the pay has not scaled up nearly as much as it should have. But that's a discussion for another day. And I do want to get into that discussion at some point with somebody that knows more about it than you or I do. But you know, I think something should happen, and you know, we'll see. But speaking of Riggs, I'd mentioned that I wanted to talk a little bit more about what happened to him after this. A couple days after the event, it was revealed by MMA Weekly that he would be undergoing surgery to repair spinal damage he suffered in the Devel fight. Diesel actually revealed he thought he was paralyzed after the slam, which was a very scary moment. He would recover, as I mentioned. He would fight 5 months after this, but he would never get the Devel rematch that he desired, unfortunately. But at least he would fully recover after these back issues and be able to get back into the cage. You know, overall, I mean, decent is probably not. I think it was decent from a production standpoint. The commentary was much improved. The presentation was better. There were some entertaining fights. But when the last three fights consist of a 46-year-old former star taking on a guy making his MMA debut, an injury-shortened bout, and then a brutally bad main event, it's hard to mark down this event as a big win. On top of that, I mean, there's literally zero recognizable fighters on this card, as far as from the Strikeforce brand. No Shamrock, no Kung Lee, no Josh Thompson, no Gilbert Melendez, not even Luke Stewart. So definitely not one of the, you know, it's definitely in the bottom of the bucket as far as top Strikeforce events. But give us your overall thoughts, Josh.
Probably there were people who watched this show because of Bob Sapp and maybe never watched MMA again, which is probably the biggest disappointment, is that when you do have these main eventers who are super prominent or famous but aren't great MMA fighters, or they have some sort of other sport background, you kind of want to use them to draw people to the sport, to highlight, look at all the undercard stuff. And we didn't really get much rub, as we would say. You know, Bob Sapp didn't really rub off onto anyone. So I think that was the biggest kind of disappointment. It just felt like kind of a bad show for Strikeforce, one that was forgettable. And I don't think it did them any damage in the long run in terms of their history and their legacy. I think it just, like, it didn't exist. It was just sort of over and done with, and they moved on. Figure Four Weekly said this about the show. The show was in many ways an experiment. They went to a new market with a localized money main event and stocked up the undercard with other local talent that hopefully would sell tickets to their friends. As noted, it was the pro wrestling indie model. All I know is that it didn't work. You could say it did work because the main event drew a lot of money, but the reality is that it came that if they came back here, they probably would only do 3,000 fans max. And to me, that's a failure. That's quoting Figure Four Weekly. And then just a little side note, I know we have some exceptions to this. James Lights Out Tony fought Randy Couture, and of course we've talked about CM Punk, and there's probably a couple of other examples, but the show kind of made me appreciate Dana White, because one thing about the early UFC was, or I should say the Fertitta brothers, Dana White era of the UFC, one thing about them was that they always made it feel like it was special. Like if you were watching UFC, you were cool, that it was something that was fresh and new. You'd go, it was so popular at sports bars. People would have people over for parties, and it was like this was the in thing. And largely that was because of Dana White treating it that way and making it feel like a great promoter, like it was unique and special. So this card kind of made me have a little bit of appreciation of him, and that we didn't see a lot of that stuff with, post, I guess, 2006, 2007, when the UFC started to sort of take off. Obviously, Dana White could have booked Bob Sapp, but he knows that would have probably hurt the credibility of other fighters. So anyway, I liked, I appreciated the Dana White aspect, but again, the fight, the show came and gone, and it's not really a part of Strikeforce's history at all.
Yeah, thankfully this was we didn't see a ton of these types of fights going forward, so I think we kind of get back on the right, and we definitely looking at what we have coming up, we definitely get back on the right track. I will mention coming up next, we'll be publishing an interview episode with MMA Junkies Gorgeous George Garcia. I mentioned that earlier in the show. It's actually next Monday as this show drops. That chat is going to drop, and we go into the influence of Strikeforce's talent on the UFC and Bellator even into today. It's a really great conversation. George shares some really cool stories, including when he learned that Strikeforce was being sold to the UFC and some different stuff like that. So we dive into a lot of really good stuff in that conversation, so make sure you keep an eye out for that. And then, as I mentioned, we get back at Strikeforce gets back on the right track. We cover a barn burner of an event in Shamrock versus Lee, where you guessed it, Frank Shamrock and Kung Lee finally lock horns for the Strikeforce middleweight title. As we record this, I actually watched that event yesterday and watched the Shamrock Lee fight last night, and it gave me goosebumps. I mean, the crowd was as hot for anything as, I mean, it was incredible, the atmosphere. So it was great, and it's a great fight. It's such an entertaining fight, and so it's going to be a lot of fun to cover that. And then after that, we are scheduled to have Kung Lee on the show. I've already interviewed him. We'll be running that in a couple weeks, and so I'm really looking forward to that one. That's a good chat too. But got some really great stuff coming up, so make sure that you have subscribed. And just I want to mention real quick the way we do the show. It's a narrative. We go in order. We're going in chronological order of the events. So if you haven't, if this is your first episode, make sure you go back and listen to our previous episodes so you can kind of see the evolution of the promotion Strikeforce as we go along. But I did want to mention that. Also mention we are on social media. You can find us on Twitter and on Instagram at Inside the Hexagon Pod. On Twitter, it's Hex at Hexagon Pod, but you can also look, search for Inside the Hexagon Pod, and we'll come up on there as well. You can also reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. I would love to hear from you. Would love to get some direct feedback from some of our listeners. Do you want the shows to have more detail, less detail? Who do you want to see on the show? Anybody you want us to try to get an interview with? Those sorts of things. So tweet, post, DM, whatever it is, or email, let us know. Also, make sure you rate and review the show. Please rate the show and review it as well. Don't just do one or the other, but please do both. But we would love to see more reviews as well. But yeah, just want to hear more from our fans and want to make sure that we are delivering the content that you want to hear. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that everybody stays safe and stays healthy. Josh, thank you for taking the time to join us on the show. Love getting your insight. Love the back and forth.
Well, Phil, thank you for all your extensive research, which allows me to try to do the Jesse Ventura role. And I have to tell you, my fans want more wrestling commentary in your podcast.
Hit me anyway. Up, people at Phil at Inside the X Men. Let me know if that's really what you want to hear. Anyway, all right. But again, with that, we're going to go ahead and take off. But stay safe, stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, GenXGrownUp.com. All right, you think that was good enough?
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right.
I've never done it. No, right.